Willoughby's authority was quite real. The orders which he allowed Granby to read were from Commodore Rowley, and indeed specific. The port, if it existed, could not be tolerated, and must be taken before it were fortified. The grounds for doing so a mere bagatelle of a technicality. The regent had ordered the remainder of the continent claimed on the basis of Fleming's circumnavigation, which might as easily have given France a claim by the journeys of La Pérouse.
"There's no sense arguing it with him, anyway," Granby said, when they had flown back to shore. "He has the bit in his teeth, and the orders are clear enough, to be just."
"If we must choose between starting a war with China now," Willoughby had said, "and starting it a year from now, when they have cannon here and are letting the French romp merrily through our trade, we will start it now. And I say it has been too long in coming, myself, when they have been giving Bonaparte one plum of a dragon after another. One despot likes another, I suppose." This was a wholesale misunderstanding of the original intention of the Chinese in sending Temeraire's egg to Napoleon, which had been done for purely interior purposes and merely to avert a question of succession, and even more so, Lien's presence amongst the French. She had fled the country in exile, suspected in treachery against the Crown Prince, and had gone to Napoleon seeking only revenge. But this was not Willoughby's deepest objection. He had added more vehemently, "And when I think of the way they snatched our East Indiamen, and all of us forced to be meek as milk to them after, I avow it must make any man worthy of the name want to put his hands to his gun. It is time and more we blacked their eye for them." Lawrence remembered well his own feelings on learning that the Chinese had confiscated four British ships, confiscated them, and forced the sailors to sail their envoy to England with neither cargo nor payment, and only peremptory demands. It had been a gross violation of sovereignty, and he had felt, with every other sailor who had heard it, the most violent fury, not lessened in the least by the cringing behaviour of government, more anxious then to prevent the entry of China into the war, or at least more sanguine that it was to be prevented. Jia Jun might, of course, have felt a similar sense of outrage when Rankin presented to him the demands for surrender through Temeraire's dubious translation, to which Temeraire added his commentary, "I do not see how this is reasonable. After all, it is stuff for the regent to say we have claimed the country, when the Larrakia are right here and have been here for ages and ages. Why, what if I were to land in London and say, 'Very well, because I am the first Chinese dragon to land in London, now I will claim it for the Emperor.' That has as much sense as this does." Rankin snapped. "It is enough. These are our orders. You may question them if you must in private, not in front of the agent or a foreign nation." "That is a very handsome way to talk," Temeraire said scathingly, "after you have been sleeping in his house and came to his dinner. It all seems to me like the sort of thing that Requiescat would do when he was behaving like a scrub. And anyway," he added, "if Jia Jun could understand whatever I was saying in English, I would not have to translate, so I do not see why I ought to be any quieter about it in front of him." Whitehall claimed a violation of the Treaty of Peking, the agreement negotiated by Hammond, wherein China had granted to Britain an equal access to any of her opened ports under the same terms as any other Western nation. If Jia Jun, with great courtesy, pointed out that this agreement said nothing whatsoever about China's granting her own merchants other and more favourable terms for export, as should be natural to any nation, and further that the port was not after all a Chinese port, but the possession of the Larrakia, if they had been so kind as to grant the Chinese the use of much of the land. "And certainly, British merchants must always be welcome, in any case. The Pomfrey, I believe," he said, "was here in the spring, her captain a pleasure to deal with, and most reasonable. I hope that Captain Willoughby will reconsider his position. Any disagreement or quarrel between our nations must be a most painful circumstance, and I fear could scarcely help but grieve the Emperor." Lawrence ignored Rankin's black looks to say,
"Mr. Jia, I hope that you might agree that the terms of the treaty are somewhat unclear, and the possession of this port itself open to dispute. Certainly left to their own devices, the Larrakia had not opened such a trade. Perhaps if the trade were suspended for a time, while our respective governments should discuss such amendments to the treaty as would satisfy them both." But Jia Jun was not to be persuaded, not without reason. He did not refuse outright, but spoke in a calm and roundabout fashion of the difficulty of managing the sea serpents, the impossibility of interrupting their peregrinations without causing their training to founder, and the expense of providing their food, which must be supported by the trade. He also, to Lawrence's dismay, spoke of the warehouses which were to be constructed, and added,
By the order of the Emperor, several craftsmen have already been commanded to prepare themselves and their families to make the journey. Longshan Li will bring them hence on her next journey. This, of course, was very like throwing tinder onto a fire, and likely only to stir further enthusiasm on Willoughby's part for immediate action.
There was no real hope, of course, Lawrence said, low and bleak, when they had ended the fruitless audience.
If it is any comfort, Tharkay said, I doubt whatever concessions you might have wrung from them would satisfy Willoughby. He is here to take the port. Nothing less will content him, and he does not strike me as that political sort of creature who might be persuaded by an appeal to his caution.
But he is wholly unreasonable, Temeraire protested. It is not as though Britain has built a port here, and the Chinese were taking it away. We had months to travel only to reach here at all.
That the port was strategically placed so as to easily wreck all of Britain's shipping and her mastery of the Indian Ocean did not appease him.
I do not see how one small country can complain if it does not rule all the oceans of the world, even those which are quite upon the other side, he said. And after all, have we not heard that Java is only on the other side of the water here, and the Dutch are there, and our friends? Why does Willoughby not go there and say, those are yours, and hand them over?
He would, Tharkay said, but they are defended with modern guns and modern navies, which can raise the price of making such a demand. Granby was kind enough to make one final attempt. They flew over with Caesar once more, and he remonstrated with Willoughby, who, if he heard, did not show any particular interest in listening. When Granby had finished, he nodded, and then said, "Well, I have heard you out, and now, Captain Granby and Captain Rankin, I'm giving you a damned order. You'll get your beasts and all these others out of the port. We scarcely need your help to secure the place, so you need not involve yourself if you do not choose to. I will be happy," he added coldly, "to forward your reasoning to Whitehall. All I require is that you do not interfere with my orders, and we will manage the thing ourselves."